Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks everybody for listening.
Great to be here as well. So something that's been happening in the news is kind of interest rates are rising and other things are falling. And it doesn't feel like the world is ending. It doesn't feel like it's as bad as other downturns in the past have been. But there still is this kind of sense of, are things bad? How bad are they? Is it going to get worse? Should we do anything? What should we do? And Trishul and I kind of want to spend a few minutes today talking about the rising interest rates, how that might affect asset allocation, falling stocks, how that might affect it. And if you've listened to any of our conversations before, you can already know it's going to come down to, you know what, you're probably fine, just don't do anything. But we do have some small, kind of super tiny tactical things that could help a little bit. But at least wanted to have the conversation. We're not trying to run away from it or stick our head in the sand. We want to kind of embrace this. And we hope that, I don't want to say how bored we are about it, but like the lax attitude we have to seeing changes in stocks and bond prices will help calm you down of, you know what, if you're still working, you're paying your bills, you're living life, nothing's actually going to change in your lifestyle based on short-term market volatility. And that tends to be kind of my bigger philosophy of what I see on Yahoo Finance page doesn't change the fact that I have a client meeting and I have to get to my daughter's softball practice later today. Like that part doesn't change. And it's not going to change by tomorrow. It's not going to change next week. It's not going to change over the next month. Like, I know what I'm doing with my time, and stocks and bonds and interest rates, like, that doesn't affect me. And therefore, I'm actually pretty able to disregard any of those negative feelings that I have. So I'm not planning on going down that path of like how I feel about market volatility. I might ask how Trishul feels as well. Today, we're thinking of being a little more kind of technical planning, but we'll see how the conversation goes. So, Trishul, when you first see interest rates are rising, or you get an email from a client, like, should we do anything? Or stocks are down. What's up? As their financial advisor, first, like, what's your first thought? And then as you kind of gather your thoughts, how do you usually respond? Whether it's via email or in a meeting?
Greg, you know, there's two key things we kind of focus on when it comes to finances. And one is the financial planning side, meaning these types of goals that you need to do over your life to make sure you accomplish the things you need to do that involve money. And the second side is the investment side, meaning, you know, just how do you grow your investments as efficiently as possible? And rising interest rates do impact both of these two buckets, but in different ways. And the response to the rising interest rates, meaning the what you can do about it, that's also quite different when it comes to financial planning and investment management. So I think they need to be kind of discussed a bit differently. When it comes to financial planning, the big impact that people are likely seeing is the rising rates on, for example, mortgages and refinancing. So what we saw before the rates started to rise, you know, towards the start of the pandemic, and frankly, it's been a trend over the last many decades, interest rates have been falling if you look at the big long-term trend. And mortgage rates have been actually going down as well. And they got so low, they hit their like 30 or 40 year lows last year in 2021. And what that essentially means is towards the tail end of last year, you saw rates go from, you know, like the 4 to 5% range, which is a good, healthy average for a 30-year fixed. You saw them drop down to the 2% range, or 2.5% range, that is. And what that effectively meant is, when those rates were going down, we saw a lot of people doing two key things. One is refinancing, right? Rates go down, you can lock in a lower rate. So if you're at a higher rate and you're able to refinance to a lower rate, your monthly payment can go down. So that's something you want to do. And there was a big rush to do that last year.
Yeah,
I did it for both of my properties, and I helped a bunch of my clients do the same. And what that also meant, though, is since rates had fallen by a good amount, it meant that individuals could afford, pound for pound, a home that had a higher market value. And the way you kind of think about that is, you know, let's say, for example, you have a budget where you can only afford a monthly payment of $1,000 a month.
Yeah.
And if rates are 4.7%, that means you can afford a home that's roughly $240,000, $250,000, putting 20% down.
Okay.
Now, if rates drop from that 4.5 range to around like 2.5, that means if nothing else changes, that same $1,000 monthly payment can afford a house that's $300,000. So that's a good, you know, like 25% jump-ish.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, housing prices jumped 25% last year. Right? Essentially, what that meant is people could afford to spend that much more because rates dropped. However, the demand increased such that the prices jumped up to compensate for that. Now, you know, who are the winners and losers in all of this? So essentially, if you were shopping for a new home last year, yes, you could purchase a house that's, you know, 30% more. However, that house likely jumped up 30% in price. So yeah, you may not have benefited too much from that, unless you know, timing and you got in early. Like the individuals who bought earlier in the year and got a pretty good rate were able to better capitalize on that than individuals who bought in later in the year, and so on. But, you know, other more easily identifiable winners were those that actually held the homes and were able to refinance at a lower rate. You know, that's more of a win-win because the rates fell, your equity value went up, so you may be able to even, you know, pull out some of that equity if you need to. And at the same time, your monthly payment could go down. So there could have been a lot of winners. And, you know, that's the benefit of having been in a property before the event happened. So that's kind of the key distinction. If you are in the right place at the right time before an event happens, you can likely benefit from it. However, once things happen, you know, once the cat's out of the bag, it might be a little too late.
I think that's probably a really good message, because that is so consistent across not just buying a house, but a wide variety of kind of decision-making processes. Is it almost never makes sense to react to the thing that changed. If you happen to do the thing before and no one could predict like when that change happens, then you benefited. But again, you can't make that decision expecting the change to get that benefit. And if you do it after, it's kind of too late. And so the change itself shouldn't impact your decision-making process. If you did it before, you got lucky, because it could also go against you. That's still always possible. And it's even possible that with rising interest rates, we see home prices fall, but you get to start like other market demand effects. But if you do the thing based on what your lifestyle is trying to accomplish, and this could be exercising options for some of my clients, it could be buying a house, could be selling stock to pay for something. It could be holding on to stock. Like these tend to be the decision making process I think about with clients. But once the thing happens, we'd have a new decision making process, but we can't apply the same kind of logic and reasoning that we were before the thing happened. And so it's really hard because sometimes it's only been a month or two since that change, but we can't make decisions beforehand expecting this benefit to happen. Because if it doesn't, we'd have to be able to kind of make sure we can maintain our lifestyle. And after it happens, it tends to only help some people who had already done it before. Does that make sense? Am I explaining this idea? Because is the idea well?
Yeah, it's such an important idea. And I think the reason it's so important is that that's not the message I see all the time in like the news and the media and even market commentators. Like, for example, I just Googled rising rates. And the first article is from CNN, how to take advantage of rising rates. And I'm reading this in real time, and I disagree with every single point on here. And, you know, this is CNN Business, which is a big website. But, you know, let me just rattle out my disappointment here and maybe, you know, just vent a bit. So, again, the main thing I'm going to express here is the point you're making, Aaron, the fact that once rate has risen, it's too late to make a decision on what to do about rising rates because rates have risen.
I'm going to guess an alternate article or alternate headline for the article could be what you should have done 4 months ago.
Well, that would be better, but let's see if it can even fit that.
Okay, go ahead.
They put it in there.
What you're doing with rising rates.
Yeah, so, okay, thing one, credit cards get to a lower rate. Yeah, well, okay, rates have risen already, so you should have done that 4 months ago. Aaron, you're right. It's still maybe not too late because you shouldn't have these high rates anyway, but that would have been good advice many months ago before the rates started to jump up. And, you know, what it even says here is rates have risen over the past year and it's likely to continue. Well, you know, frankly, that second part is the crux of what this whole argument relies on the things that you should do. And frankly, that's the failure point of the entire article, from my perspective. It's the end is likely to continue part. What it's actually saying by that is, I've seen a recent trend, and I think that trend will continue because I've seen a recent trend.
I had the same thought. It's like, the stock went up. You should buy this stock because it has gone up. It's like, no, you should have bought the stock before it went up. Just because it went up recently doesn't mean that's going to continue. The time to buy the stock is before it goes up.
And when we hear these types of things, what I really like to do is just step back and say, look, if the markets were that easy, we all would be rich.
Yeah.
It's just not that easy. You can't just say, I've seen a trend and that trend will continue. For example, if everybody thought it would continue, well, then the market would know about it and it would have already reacted to that.
Yeah.
That's just how it works. You can't get around that. So the fact that they're saying to do these things because they think something will continue that the market doesn't know about, but these people do, it just doesn't make sense. So especially if they're relying on,
maybe a better phrase for the article could be, if you think interest rates are going up in the future, here's how you could take advantage of it. But the true, like, full disclosure part of an article would be like, but if interest rates don't go up in the future, here's how you would be hurt.
Yeah,
like,
but
it's like, yeah, like, one, don't like predicting the future. Two, you're only looking at the pros or the benefits without looking at the downside of the cost or the cons.
I agree. And you know, the first few words of your sentence, if you think interest rates are likely to go up, well, if you think that and you can know that with enough predictability, you should be making money in the market and retired.
Yes. Okay.
Means you have an informational advantage on everybody else.
Yes.
So, what this article is saying is that by reading this article, you will have an informational advantage over everybody else.
Over everyone who, you know what? That's why I see it as business model. If you read this article, you have an informational advantage over the people who don't read this article.
Right. And, the magic that they're saying is rates have gone up, so they're likely to continue.
Okay. So, given that logical fallacy, what are some other things that they suggest you should do with to take advantage of rising rates?
Okay, so they even repeated the same words. Number two, home loans lock in fixed rates now. Well, yes.
contact a mortgage broker or bank. What loan can you? What interest rate can you get right now?
Okay, so let's check rates. The notion is, again, we don't know if rates are going to keep going up. If we did, we could use that and exploit that. But if the market really thought rates are going up, they would already have gone up to anticipate that move. That's just how the markets work.
Yeah.
And they may go up, that they may go down, but the way that any market price is set is such that there should be a roughly equal probability of going in any direction. If there was a strong belief that it should be higher, then market participants would push it higher.
Yeah.
That's in general how all of these instruments behave, such that it should be a random walk from this point forward.
Okay. So go back 4 months and lock in your lower interest rate.
Right.
Okay. What's next?
Number two. Okay. Number three, bank savings shop around. I'm reading this in real time, so I don't know what that means, but let's see. It says if you're stashing cash at big banks and have been paying next to nothing in savings account, I guess shop around. That's what it's trying to say. Sure. Yeah. I guess that's something to do. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah. Kind of if one bank is paying more, because again, you have to account for the way the bank's money is that they're going to pay out a rate on their savings account CDs, but they use that money to lend in the form of mortgages, and banks make money on that spread, that difference between the interest rate they're receiving from mortgage and other borrowers and the interest rate they pay out to the savers. So if one bank is going to be getting more competitive, they're going to try to kind of reduce their margins to bring in market share, where they're already getting high 4% on their mortgages now. And so for new savings, new CDs, they can afford to go higher on those rates than we have seen over the last few years. And then your current bank isn't trying to stay competitive. They're trying to maximize their own internal profits. Then, I think that it's not necessarily a rising interest rates thing of like just your bank is trying to take more of the money that you can. This other bank is trying to give you more to be more competitive and attract that business.
Yeah. What I might even add to that is you should probably, if you're concerned about this, shop around at any time, because this could be an issue whenever, So I think this would apply, not only now, but also every other time in the past and future.
Yes, that's a great point. Like, you could always try to shop around to see if one bank will give you an extra 0.25% than your current bank.
Yeah,
I'd say the other thing is but weigh the difference between what that change would be, like the actual time and energy. The phrase I've seen on Twitter that I kind of like is return on hassle. Like, if you have all of your direct deposits going to the same checking account and all of your bills being paid from that checking account, trying to get an extra 0.5% by moving to another bank is probably not worth it. It's probably just going to take way too much time. And again, the banks kind of know this so that they can kind of take advantage of that. But have an idea of here's how much I keep in my checking, here's how much I keep in like a linked savings, but then my other cash reserve amount that I don't mind moving around because I'm not taking in or out of it on a regular basis. So that's why I like keeping that separate checking to, is kind of your operational account, your inflows, outflows, separate from your reserve where you can find that more competitive interest rate.
Yeah. What I might actually plug here is, well, two key points. One, inflation is pretty high now, so having a large cash balance, you're going to get burned no matter what rate you're probably getting at your bank.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of losing a lot or losing slightly less than a lot due to inflation is probably how that's going to pan out. However, the other thing I might throw in is, you know, one, not keep a large cash balance if you don't need to, right? Just cap out that emergency fund based upon 3 to 6 months of needs, depending on your necessities. And, you know, the other thing is just a little plug for the tool that I use. It's called Max My Interest. You can probably Google it or we'll put a link in the show notes. The notion there is it automatically moves your excess cash position to banks that offer a higher rate. And often that's higher than the rate at the bank you're at for many of the reasons Aaron mentioned. So that might be a way to not have to do the shopping around every now and then, that, you know, that this type of software or program can do that for you.
I'm okay. I kind of like that. This goes back to like the financial planning side. I've found the psychological benefits with some clients of keeping large cash position, whether it is kind of like an FU money kind of thing, or they don't have to put up with kind of difficult bosses, difficult coworkers. They have greater benefit by keeping a larger cash position. But we're not keeping that cash position trying to get a rate of return. I tend not to care what the rate of return is on cash. I don't even look at it for myself, because the reason we keep cash is all the other lifestyle benefits, not for the rate of return. So I agree with you, kind of like your cash is losing to inflation, but it's not why you're keeping cash. You're keeping cash so that if something happens, you don't have to worry. You have less stress and anxiety in your life because you have that cash sitting around. This is not money you're trying to grow anyways.
I'm just curious, in a 2 to 3% inflation world, that seems more palpable. I'm wondering if you've seen any change in mindset in the 7% world we've been in lately for larger than emergency fund cash positions.
So I guess the best way to phrase it is the clients I know who have the largest cash positions, it's something like they want to be able to cover a year's worth of expenses.
Okay.
They have kind of a number of costs or expenses that they want to have in cash, kind of just in case. It's also, again, it's never more than 5% of their net worth. Again, it's not enough to be a drag on their overall net worth, but it is a larger than kind of average cash position, but they chose that and they feel comfortable with that. Whereas whether it's kind of sometimes it's also, I've seen clients who have their expenses are greater than their monthly income, but less than their annual income. So a decent amount of their income comes in an annual bonus that is consistent enough that they can depend on it for expenses. So it's kind of a cash flow strategy. So they'll keep extra large cash position after that bonus. It kind of gets spent down over a year until that bonus comes back up.
Right.
Because again, like they have the money, they have the income. They're also saving really well. It's just a kind of a cash flow strategy where if this is money we're going to spend in the next year, I don't want to take any risk with it. Like, we know it's going to go to funding lifestyle. So this tends to be kind of another example of where we keep kind of extra large cash positions at some point when I don't care about the interest rate.
Right. No, that makes sense. You know, 5% of net worth is not extreme, and can make sense depending on an individual's risk tolerance. So I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What's next on this list of things you should
have
done 4 months
ago,
or do anytime?
Well, okay. So the next one, I disagree on it just on the headline. Stocks consider pricing power, because I know where this is going, but I'm going to read it anyway. So let's see. When deciding whether to invest in a company or a sector that might do well in a rising environment, especially one marked by inflation that is being driven by a strong economy, blah, 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 consider what companies will have pricing power in an inflationary environment, said somebody from some wealth company. You can read the name in from the link in the show notes. But the main point here is there's a difference between which companies will do better in a rising interest rate environment versus which companies will do better once interest rates have already risen and you don't know if they're going to go up or down from here. Because the moment those interest rates rise, everybody, all these computers and modelers and financial analysts and hedge funds and so on, they're going to say, oh, okay, we're in a different regime. Let's re-rate our models. Let's figure out the new price for these companies that do better in a higher inflationary environment. And let's, you know, buy and sell and trade those positions so that those stocks reflect that new information. Okay, and at that point, once you try to, that's all priced in, is the main point.
Yeah. Okay. So it's the theory of companies who can raise their prices with inflation, again, that pricing power to maintain revenues. Like, yes, those companies can do well in a rising interest rate environment, but the stock price already went up to reflect that. Again, you needed to go back and buy that company before the rising interest rates. If the advice is to buy the stock of this particular company, it's too late.
Right. Nobody disagrees with the fact that there are certain businesses that do well in a rising interest rate environment. However, once interest rates have risen, those companies' prices of their equity have already been adjusted by market participants.
Okay. So what's next on the thing you should have done 4 months ago? You could do any time.
Maybe we should ask CNN Business if they'd like a new title. Okay, so here's an important one. Again, just right off the title, bonds go short. I don't think we need to read the rest.
So this is like bonds have gone down 10%. Because of rising interest rates, which makes sense. Like, as interest rates go up, what was a 4% bond is less valuable than a new 5% bond. So that this is kind of the classic seesaw. Like, as interest rates go up, bond prices go down. But again, if you buy the bonds now, you need either more rising interest rates, which again is not a safe assumption for those prices to go down, so shorting it, or you should have done this 4 months ago. You have to do the thing before the change.
Right. And the way this kind of plays out is, for example, the Feds have raised their rates in January, March, and May. It's May 11th right now, so the last raise was last week, May 4th. And a few things. You know, all of last year, rates were pretty low, like basically zero, but like 0.25% was the target for all of 2021. And then in March, in March was the first raise, sorry, they doubled it, so 0.25 to 0.5. And then in May, they doubled it again, so 0.5 to 1%. So that 0.5% jump in May was actually a pretty big jump. It's the largest jump in two decades, So, you know, it's something that doesn't happen too often and probably not in many of our investment lifetimes so far. But it's a pretty big move that a few things. One, market participants were strongly under the understanding that such a large jump was in the pipeline. So it wasn't, you know, you wake up one day and all of a sudden the news comes out and you're half a point higher. Many people had expected rates to jump between 0.5% and 0.75%. You know, frankly, when the rates actually jumped 0.5% instead of 0.75, I remember the market rallied that day because people were expecting higher, right? Yeah. But the main point is there was enough market consensus that rates were going to rise by a good amount well before May 4th or maybe well before the March announcement. And what we saw is that bond prices were following in anticipation of those things that many people understood were very likely to occur. So it's one of the things where there's already a market understanding of how things are going to go, and the market has moved accordingly. Now, one thing to understand is we saw a quarter point and a 0.5% jump, but a far larger drop in bonds. And, you know, that just has to do with this notion of convexity and duration. You know, the idea
I don't really want to get into too much of that yield curve discussion, but I did have a note here of there is a difference between the Fed funds rate, that short-term overnight borrowing rate, that's what you're talking about, that raised from 0.5% to 1%, and mortgage rates that tend to be more tied with 10-year treasury rates. So that's why you can see rising interest rates in the news, but mortgages might stay the same if the 10-year treasury doesn't reflect that, because the Federal Reserve, the governors, I think, the governors, board of governors, or the governors of the Federal Reserve, like, they actually decide that short-term rate. The 10-year treasury is market-based. It's kind of what rate can they get by selling 10-year treasuries, and that tends to line up with the mortgage rates, in part because that's how banks kind of fund the mortgages. They look at, okay, here's what we have to pay on this kind of long term, or here's what we can expect to get for some of our reserve positions. But there is a difference between rising interest rates being that short term, the funds rate. You see that, you tend to see that in like money markets and anything that's tied to the Wall Street Journal Prime Index. I used to look at LIBOR, but I've looked at LIBOR a lot less since some of the concerns about the rate fixing. But the Fed funds rate and prime are short term interest rates, whereas the mortgage rates tend to be on those longer term. And so, like, both are affected, and they kind of, like, rising interest rates can do both, but they're not the same. I wonder if you want to add to, without having to explain, like, yield curve and convexity, just that idea of we can have rising interest rates in the short term, but if kind of market sees economic outlook to be similar, mortgages could stay lower.
Yeah, I won't make it too complex, but there's this notion of short-term and long-term rates, right? So rates across different time periods. And if you plot those on the chart, you get something known as a yield curve, right? And that curve can move in various directions. For example, the slope of the curve can change. And also the curve can just move, you know, let's say it's slightly upward sloping as you get longer durations, meaning the longer term rates are higher than the shorter term rates. That's your standard environment, right?
That's the idea, like the super, like, oversimplifying credit quality. But if there is a probability that a company goes bankrupt or some other thing doesn't pay that rate, it's less likely to go bankrupt within the next year, whereas just existing longer implies there's a chance it goes bankrupt 8 years from now, 9 years from 10 years from now. And so your risk with everything else stay the same. All the financials stay the same. All the credit cards stay the same. Just the fact that they're borrowing longer, that risk does go up with more time. The risk that they default at some point in the future is higher than if they default in the next year.
Yeah,
so that's why we normally have a rising interest rate curve.
Exactly. More time means more chance of bad things happening. So
yes, exactly.
Market participants require higher rates for longer duration bonds. And, you know, that's the typical environment, so that curve can, you know, just kind of shift upwards. You know, everything can move up a percent, or the slope can change. And that natural upward sloping slope that we see in normal times, it can actually flatten or it can turn negative, so that can give us some understanding of how things are today. Again, not necessarily telling us how things are going to be in the future, but more postcasting on, you know, where are we at now. And what we've kind of seen is basically a shift in the curve up, but also the slope increasing. And that actually points to what we might expect in a rising interest rate environment, because when interest rates jump a little bit in the short-term rate, typically longer-term instruments, it has a multiplier effect of it. So you see a higher jump in longer-term rates. You also see a higher sensitivity to bond prices for longer duration interest rates or longer duration instruments for changes in interest rates. So that's likely why you were seeing, you know, that 0.75% jump in the short-term rate led to a 10% drop in your longer-term bonds in terms of their market price.
Yeah.
To compensate for that. So that's basically the main point. You know, that shorter-term rate, that short-term rate jump that we saw with the Fed has flowed through a bit into where we're seeing mortgage rates go up by more than that 0.75%, or that's what we've seen.
Okay, so I want to get into kind of discussing real return, but I want to, like, do you have anything else from that CNN checklist of things you should have done 4 months ago that we should finish off with?
Well, okay, so yeah, basically the high-level point with bonds is bonds are already down close to 10%, and a few things. That's because the rates have risen, you know, off of historical lows, and we saw, again, a pretty big jump, a jump that, for example, we haven't seen in 22 years, and also a large increase in rates in mortgage prices. So then, you know, the question is, at a high level, what happens from here? You know, again, the CNN article is saying go short, but is now the time to go short after the rates have already risen? And the way to kind of think about that is, again, you have to think that rates are going to rise from here, and you have to believe that they're going to rise more than the market expects for that thesis to be true. And it's quite likely that, you know, there has been a pile-on effect, right, of people thinking that rates are going to rise even more by reading CNN Business, right? That rates have maybe even overshot. I'm not predicting that, but I'm saying these types of things tend to happen. You know, when things look good, markets tend to overreact. And when things look bad, markets tend to overreact. So over long periods of time, you see this kind of bouncing back of, oh, market went up too much over last year and it retracted, and so on, with rates going down too much and it might pull back. So that's basically the high level, that's the article in itself. But again, what can you do about the bonds already being low? Well, you know, I will add one thing, though. For example, you may have heard that I-bond rates are pretty favorable right now. They're paying an interest rate of around 9%, which is pretty solid for a government bond, right?
Yeah.
For a one-year rate. However, there are some caveats. One, that rate is only for a small amount of money. You can only invest $10,000 to $15,000 per Social Security number. And if you have a much larger cash position, that may not make a big difference. And also, that rate is fixed for the next 6 months, meaning it's 9% divided by 2 for the next 6 months. And then 6 months after that, there will be a new rate announced. We don't know if that will be higher or lower. But if you look at long-term prices or long-term I-bond rates, they're actually not that high in most periods. In fact, the whole point is if you just do that type of strategy all the time, you'll likely underperform standard bonds because there shouldn't be free money by doing something else that everybody knows about.
Yeah, yeah. All right. And that's one of the things I've actually had conversations with clients is, yes, maybe if you had gone back in 4 months, I didn't say that specifically, but this might have been okay, but long-term, inflation-protected securities tend to underperform other intermediate-term, longer-term bond strategies. Like the bond strategies we're already using over a longer time period have a better performance relative to the risk than I-bonds or are there any other inflation-protected security.
Right, yeah. So. It just goes back to your new title for this article.
Yeah. So my note here, all I wrote down was real return. So I'm going to try to like think out loud a little bit.
Okay.
But one of the things that we've done a pretty good job in the past of is talking about real return. This is the inflation adjusted return of whatever. And this is one of the reasons why kind of we use stocks to outpace inflation. I don't like the idea of using bonds to outpace inflation because, again, while I-bonds specifically might keep pace with inflation, they're not going to outpace it. But stocks outpace inflation. And there's my thought here was kind of the conversation between real return and maybe like valuations kind of thing. I'm trying to think like it's the idea of when we talked about long-term real returns, we still expect stocks to outpace them by a good delta, something like 5 to 7% is roughly a long-term real return of stocks. And if inflation is a concern, we'd actually expect kind of greater nominal returns from stocks over the long run. And this kind of ties into if stocks are going down now, this actually increases the long-term outlook from this point forward. Just kind of like if we expected a stock to go from 100 to 110, or it's an average 10%. And that's kind of like the way the fundamentals work. And we'll get that 10% compounded, but it goes down from 100 to 90. There's still enough underlying fundamentals that if it goes from 90 to 110, our rate of return from that point forward looks better, even though we still kind of only got that 100 to 110 like effect in our portfolio. And so I that's another reason why I tend not to be concerned about downturns is it doesn't change my lifestyle, but I still have kind of the same longer term outlook that the stock side of my portfolio is going to outpace inflation by a good amount. And I think everything's going to be just fine. Like I have stocks only for long term. I don't have them for the short term stuff. And so I was trying to think like that other like intersection between real return, like either like PE or some kind of valuation idea. But also, again, that long-term idea as opposed to just what happens now.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the key here, the long-term focus. We know, you know, over market cycles, things tend to look good if you have a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds that are risk-aligned to your tolerance levels. And what we're seeing now is a bunch of volatility that we haven't seen in a good amount of time, frankly. You know, for bonds, we haven't seen it in a very long time. And for stocks, it's also been quite a while. I'd say maybe, you know, we saw that flash in 2020 when the pandemic first started, where stocks tanked about, you know, 30% and then quickly came back that 30%. You know, that may be the next comparable period. But perhaps the only other comparable period before that is like 2008, where you saw that big drop in bond prices and stock prices due to the financial crisis driven by mortgages and leverage and whatnot. but again, over long periods of times, but both of these asset classes, stocks and bonds, have still done favorably, even with all of that bad stuff that went on.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's hard to say that we've seen a regime change that's secular in nature, such that we're in a completely different world. Like, you know, bonds don't work as they used to, or stocks don't work as they used to.
Yeah, it's, I remember in 2020, I was kind of telling my friends casually, it's like, I'll look at the 1 year trailing. If the 1 year trailing starts to look bad on the S&P 500, then I start paying attention. And it's now negative. So the S&P 500 is now negative 5% on the last year. It's like, okay, this is something. So I'm not thinking it's a negative 20%. That's the kind of the peak to trough, which also happens to line up with kind of the year to date. But seeing like a negative 5% over a trailing 12 months, that doesn't sound as scary. I guess. And again, it's totally could keep getting worse. That would not surprise me at all. Again, going since 2008 to kind of go that long without kind of an extended year plus downturn, I think that's on the longer side. So I'm not trying to predict the future, but wouldn't surprise me if this keeps going down. Also, kind of see things like just a lot of good things happening in the economy, like rising interest rates are rising in part because the economy is strong, and that gives me just enough positive vibes of like, yeah, let's wait a few years and we'll probably be fine, or maybe it takes longer. I don't know, but long term, your day to day lifestyle isn't going to change. Long term, you'll be just fine. And so, like, I tend not to be fazed by what happens year to date.
Yeah, no, I agree. another way I kind of put this into perspective is in 2021, the S&P is up 22%, and this year is down 17%. But in bizarre world, what if last year the S&P was up 2.5%, and year to date it's up 2.5% this year?
Yeah.
You still have the same amount of growth over, you know, January 1st of 2021 till now. But in one conversation, the world's burning down, and the other conversation, it's business as usual.
Yeah. Yeah. I think look at the 2 year S&P 500 is still up 35% over the 2 years. So maybe I need to change. Instead of looking at the 1 year trailing, I'll start looking at the 2 year trailing. Like, oh yeah, things look great.
Yeah, or you know, Warren Buffett style. Look at the 50-year trailing, meaning 50-year trailing. Don't look.
Yeah. Okay, 5 year still up 75%.
Right. Yeah. So you know, even when it comes to bonds, I've relayed these numbers before. For example, here are the bond returns for any given year starting in 2008, which was a good year for bonds.
Real quick, that was my thought. I remember now, was even though bonds are down 10% because interest rates have risen, same idea with the stock kind of valuation and real returns. Like, we'd actually expect bonds to have stronger returns over the next 10 years than they have over the previous 10 years, because they will benefit from those higher interest rates, those higher mortgage rates, those higher 10-year. We would expect bonds to have stronger returns moving forward than they have in the past. That was my other thought of bonds and rising interest rates. Sorry.
No, okay. That's a really good point, because I'm just going to kind of play off that at this point. So here are the annual bond returns for like the U.S. bond market. I do the global one, but it doesn't go back that far with the data. But I'm just going to read the number to the left of the decimal. So I'll round to the nearest whole number. Okay, 8%, 3%, 6%, 8%, 4%, negative 2%, one of the only negative years, or the worst negative years until this year. We'll see how this year plays out. Negative 2% in 2013. Okay, so 6%, 0%, 3%, 4%, 0%, 9%, 9%, 8%, negative 2% for last year. And this year, we are down about 10%. Now, a few things. The worst bond peak to trough since 1920s is about negative 14%. So we're close to the worst we've seen in 100 years.
Yeah.
And yeah, to the point you made, Aaron, it's a lot easier to have a high bond return when rates are in the 4% range versus when you're at the 0% range, because a few things. You know, bond, you get a return based upon the interest rate, right? The amount of interest you can get. Well, zero isn't high. And also, when interest rates fall, then the value of the bonds go up. Well, if it's at zero, how much can they fall?
Yeah.
And so what we're seeing is the flip side of that. Okay, we're back to like a normal interest rate world, close to like 4.5% on like the mortgages, for example. There could still actually be some rise in the short-term rate. But again, if that's quite known, you know, that the Fed is going to raise rates for another 0.25%, you know, each quarter for X amount of quarters, that's likely priced in, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, does it mean you should short bonds, right? If you think about it from that perspective, you know, based upon what CNN Business is trying to say, or does it mean you should do the opposite? Or should you just say, hey, I don't know, but yeah, over long periods, bonds are sensible. You know, that's where I come out.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels almost, I don't say it's more than weird, but like the fact that I can almost like turn off, what just happened and only looking forward. Like, it's almost like you're like no rear view mirrors. You can only look forward, and it's like, ooh, bond rates are going to look good moving forward. Like, none of this like 1% to 3% bond returns. Let's get some up to like 4% or 5% bond returns. This is going to be nice. Ooh, look at all these valuations on stocks. We're going to get 10%+ on our stocks. We're going to look good over the next decade. But like, it takes the things going down to see that moving forward. And so it's like, I remember conversations a year ago. It's like, maybe valuations are kind of high. Like, we can expect below average 10-year outlooks, whether that's a crash that we start to cover or just kind of muted returns or keeps going up and then drops at some point in the future. Like, we don't know how it's going to play out. So now, like, okay, we got that went down. So, like, okay, things look better moving forward.
Yeah, no, that it's interesting because, okay, so here are some things you can actually do or that I think make sense, you know, given where we're at right now. One of those things is, yeah, erase that history from your decision-making and just understand, based upon where we are now, how do things look? Do we still have confidence that the stock markets are a sensible thing to invest in over, you know, a very long time horizon? Well, okay, yeah. What has changed with that? And then, yeah, with bond rates where they are, is it still a sensible investment to invest in bonds if they're at a 4% rate versus where they were, if, you know, 6 months ago, where they were half that, and we still thought it was a sensible investment? Well, yeah, it seems like it would be even better. And then for those individuals who, I'm not saying they should have been market timing, but if somehow they had more cash on hand that they had liked, well, yeah, that, it does seem like a better time to buy than 6 months ago, because,
yeah,
you know, you get like a little reset there. Now, I'm not saying that should be a strategy, but if you happen to find yourself in a position with extra cash, well, then the same things that you would have bought, you know, earlier this year are at a 20% discount in the equity markets.
Yeah, yeah. I have, I think, at least two clients we just happen to be going through that. It's like, okay, and again, it was not a market timing thing. It's like, okay, we sold something before the end of the calendar year. If we're going through tax season, what's going to have much money set aside for taxes? Okay, we had set aside a little extra because we're conservative, so now we have some extra cash that we're at through tax season. Okay, let's start to reinvest this. And okay, this looks so much better to reinvest today than it did in December. This is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I remember at the beginning of January, there was a big concern that markets were at all-time highs. This is January of 2021, by the way.
I remember that.
You know, we had this conversation. So, you know, our listeners can look back and try to, you know, pull up that episode. I think I even wrote a blog post about it. And, you know, the concern was we're at a all-time high and we don't want to be investing at the top. But if you invested today, after all the mess we've gone through this year, you would still be buying things at a higher price than it was back then.
Yeah, I think you're right. There you go. February 9th, 2021, episode number 61. The market's at all-time high. Again, now what?
Right. Right.
So, yeah, if you had gotten out, you would have missed on the 20%+ return that, let's see, pull up my Google Finance again, February of 2021, because Trishel is able to predict the future. We're still higher now than the S&P 500 is still higher now than February 2021. Even right. After what happened over the last month or a couple months.
Right. Yeah. Right. Again, not to say I have any idea where it's going in the short term.
Sorry, I thought the new headline is Trishel can predict the future.
Right. We should email CNN Business.
Okay. So I like that. I love a conversation with you because it feels weird, like happy to be discussing what happened. Like, there's so much fear and anxiety, but I genuinely feel like joy from our conversation. I just love these conversations.
Me too, Aaron. It's good to understand that it doesn't always have to be doom and gloom, even when the sky is falling.
Yep. 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 I'd actually be curious if any listeners have any other true specific stories of that silver lining that all this bad stuff happened, but because stuff came down, I got to do this. I'd love to hear more specifics from other clients and other listeners.
Yeah, I would too. And I definitely enjoyed the conversation, Aaron. And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're enjoying these conversations, don't forget to subscribe, like, and share. All right, thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.